Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And in our appeals to heaven, we need to absorb the content that is critical, that helps define, that helps clarify what each part of the Constitution means. That way, as we look at the Constitution and the powers of the government, because the Constitution's a power of attorney. It's a limited and defined power of attorney. It's not a general power. Go figure out what you need to do and go do it. It says you can do this, 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 and this. Anything else, you got to ask for permission, and it needs to be added to the Constitution, granted to you, before you can do it. It's kind of that simple. This is why we need to recognize that the crap that they've been doing, they've not had the authority to do many things, a plethora of things. 99% plus of what they spend money on as far as government, they have no authority to spend it. That's why it's unconstitutional. That's why we have to say, hey, you are fraudulently debasing the government without the authority. You have no authority to do that. This is why we don't owe that debt. They can only do those things that we granted to them. It's not like we're giving them... So welcome back, Sean.
Thank you.
So... is there any inclination that in the election process we're giving our government a blank check?
No, sir.
We're basically electing representatives. We should be electing electors to choose the president, but we choose the president. But there's nowhere there that we say we're giving you a blank check. And one of the things we know is we know that they're going to be held to an oath. And that oath is to keep them within the framework and structure of the Constitution. They don't do that, then there's supposed to be consequences to that. Now, there's lots of people that are basically communists that are cheering on unconstitutional behavior, yelling and demanding it needs to be protected. And there are communists in office that are actually running protection and interference. Folks, it's an easy problem. You have to stop electing communists. You have to actually make sure you understand what the Constitution is, your local community. That's why we create these constitutional compliance committees at your county level. And then you need to make sure that the counties drive that up to the state so that they have a constitutional compliance assembly, you know, committee, what have you, at the state legislator level, so that they are kept in check. And once the states are kept in check, then it makes it real easy to keep the federal government in check. One begot the other, that begot the other, begot, right? I mean, so anyway, so we're covering the Constitution, and what we kind of stopped, and I didn't mean to stall, but we're at a point where the Constitution, a significant part of it, really changed. And therefore, reading this part of Section 2 is wrong because it doesn't apply anymore. In the Bill of Rights, when they decided how the process of amending the Constitution was going to go, Madison argued that the text that was to be changed within the body of the Constitution literally wiped out that the old and the new was inserted. And Roger Sherman was the one that said, no, it needs to be amended at the end. We don't want to be changing the original text. And Madison said, well, that causes confusion. When a person reads the Constitution and then they go through it, they may not have any inkling that a portion of an amendment may affect a text above. And he goes, well, those of us in government would know. And as far as I'm concerned, Roger Sherman had the wrong paradigm. I believe Madison was right. And I believe
that the states, in for the states' benefit, and I say this because if you look at the 11th Amendment and the changing of jurisdiction of the federal court, the 11th Amendment would be a very significant change so that when people read it, they will never misconstrue the jurisdiction of the court ever again by removing that text out of Article 3, Section 2, which is what the 11th Amendment changes. Same thing with the 12th Amendment. So, and this is why our Electoral College is so confused. Now, technically, the 12th Amendment became necessary because it was too difficult for the electors to choose the president. And so they casted, and I believe back in those days, the electors, you know, participated in multiple different choices and so forth. And I think the electors actually rode to, you know, D.C., to the seat of government in 1800, and they actually provided their votes, and they kept on re-voting and re-voting. The 12th Amendment actually changed that process to limit it, and there's actually some limitations in Article 2 of if they can't choose, you know, in the first ballot, they can't choose a clear winner, then they have to do this, and then they have to do this, and then it goes to Congress or whatever it is. So the 12th Amendment changed two things. It changed how the electors were to vote and to choose, how to choose, and it literally changed the attempts of choosing the president. So let's go ahead, and if you can remember kind of what you read here, because we're going to compare it against the 12th Amendment. Okay, so the electors shall meet in their respective states.
The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all their certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be President, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if there be more than one who have such a majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for president. And if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list, the said House shall in like manner choose the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states, and a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. In every case, after the choice of the president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president. But if there should remain two or more who have equal votes, the Senate shall choose from them by ballot the vice president.
Okay, now, that was the original process. Now we just need to jump down to the 12th Amendment, which is down a ways. And we start off with a little purple. And it says, the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president. In other words, they're to vote and choose the president and the vice president. That is purple, right? Because today, the president chooses who the vice president is, and even though the electors may write that name down, they are not choosing, they are not voting for that person. They're adding who the president had chosen. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
That's the first thing I thought about when I read that. I was like, what? That's right. Not how it goes.
That's right. So in other words, there was a reason why, based on the 12th Amendment, why a slave sympathist, Andrew Johnson, became vice president under Lincoln. It was to kind of create a dichotomy or, you know, the two different views within the administration so there wouldn't be one-sided. And so the parties didn't like that because it becomes very, inhibiting. You know, they become a little encumbered because they, you know, you got a vice president, because that actually happened with Adams and Jefferson. They did not see eye to eye in how to govern as the executive. And Jefferson was very critical of Adams. Anyway, okay, so now let's read the rest of this.
The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves.
Can we stop right there? Sorry. So that's a requirement. It's a maintained requirement that one of those whom they choose shall not be an inhabitant. In other words, they both can't be inhabitants of the same state. That every state has to make sure that both candidates don't have this residency within your state. Here's the question, because we're told that the president and the vice president can't come from the same state, right? You hear people say that Ron DeSantis and President Trump could not be the ticket for the presidential campaign of 2024. But is that correct?
It would seem from the reading that that's correct.
So, actually, what would happen if you had Ron DeSantis and President Trump on the ballot? The state of Florida would be forced to choose a different vice president or a different president. But all other states would be free to choose both, right? Because the only requirement is that both cannot be an inhabitant of the same state. So is Trump and DeSantis an inhabitant of Mississippi? Are they inhabitants of New York? Are they inhabitants of any of the other states other than Florida?
Oh, okay.
See, this is how people read things, and they create crap and myth, and now everybody believes that the president and the vice president cannot reside in the same state and be president and vice president.
The elector and the president.
So, no, it says that when the electors are choosing, they have to make sure that they're not from the same state with themselves. In other words, as the electors of Florida are choosing, they need to make sure that at least one of those who they choose is not an inhabitant of that same state. So when you go to Mississippi, that problem doesn't exist with with Trump and DeSantis. That problem doesn't exist in any other state. It only exists where that problem would kick in and they would have to either vote for somebody else and or they would have to vote for, you know, the vice president and somebody else. And so this is where they could easily create this parity where you wouldn't have necessarily a majority, but you'd have 50-50, 50-50, something like that, to where it became kind of a tie, or, you know, at least you get one and not the other. However you solve that, but that doesn't mean just because you don't carry Florida means that they can't be president and vice president. And so this arbitrary rule that everybody kicks, you know, they spit out every they can't be from the same state. No, that's not true. Where did you derive that from? Because this is where it's being driven, and that's not what it says. Okay. All right. This is an important point to make, because there is this huge myth that the president and the vice president could not come from the same state. Let me ask you this. The 12th Amendment kicked in, right, in 1803. James Madison and Thomas Jefferson James Madison was Secretary of State. He wasn't Vice President. I think Aaron Burr was the Vice President. They actually had different Vice Presidents back then. The Secretary of State was literally the guy in position to become the next President. because the involvement in the foreign affairs and so forth, they wanted to keep the vice president kind of non-involved, because that way they would be able to maintain a secession by going to the Secretary of State, because he understood the foreign policies, which is the most important function of the president, foreign policy. So anyway, I digress. Let's go ahead and pick up the rest of it now. So you left off with the same state with themselves. So
right.
You pick up...
They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots, the person voted for as vice president. And they shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president and of all persons voted for as vice president, and the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate.
Okay. Keep going.
Okay. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and the House of Representatives, open all certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if no persons have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from two-thirds of the states, and a majority of all states shall be necessary to a choice. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president, whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them before the fourth day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as president, as in the case of death or other constitutional disability of the president. The person having the greatest number of votes as vice president shall be the vice president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. And if no person have a majority, then from the two highest numbers on the list, the Senate shall choose the vice president. A quorum for the purpose shall consist of two-thirds of the whole number of senators, and a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice. But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States.
Yeah, and so the problem is they never created a real process to confirm eligibility, right? And that's how we've had the fiasco with Obama and so forth and so on. And Kamala Harris was another one. And we've actually had fiascos on the Republican side with Haley, what's her name?
Nikki Haley,
thank you. And Vivek Ramaswamy. They should never have been candidates. They can't be candidates. That needs to be done well in advance so that people don't, you know, all of a sudden attach themselves, because people become so fanatic. I mean, it's just like a bunch of, not to be disparaged towards girls, but girls just seem to get this fanatic love affair going on in their teenage years over rock stars or what have you, and it just goes overboard. But anyway, that's what we see in politics today. I mean, people just lose all reason. Oh, that's my man, that's my boy, that's my girl. Anyway, so...
identity politics.
Yes. So it becomes really clear here that if you can't choose the president, then it goes to the House of Representatives. And if you can't choose the vice president, I think you get one shot at doing it, you know, to try to fix it up. Because it says, and if no person shall have such majority from the persons having the highest numbers not exceeded, three on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately. In other words, they just take the top three, give them to the House. So they don't, that the Electoral College doesn't continue to meet. And then it tells you right there that the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president, but in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by the states, the representative of each state being one vote or by quorum. In other words, California gets one vote. New York, one vote. Which means that in 2020, because the Electoral College was incapable of choosing the president, and the top two was literally Biden and Trump, the top two choices would have been given to, because there was really no third choice. The numbers weren't even close. So, in other words, I think it goes by, if there isn't a clear choice, that the top three that could have become a clear choice, none of the other candidates could have ever become a choice. So the point is that Biden and Trump would have gone to the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives in 2020 would have chosen the president. Or actually, I believe the Electoral College would then give it to them as their list of who they chose. However, the House of Representatives and the President Pro Tem should have identified that only 139 electors were legitimate constitutional electors. The rest of the Electoral College, this is old news, but there was a big lawsuit on this that I helped support Bob Schultz of the We the People Foundation on, and this lawsuit proved that only 139 electors were constitutionally chosen. The others were chosen unconstitutionally because the laws changed unconstitutionally. Only the state legislature can dictate when and the time, place, and manner of the choosing of the electors. And therefore, when the governor, because of emergency powers, kicked in, he may have been able to do things, but he could not touch that law. They had to basically hold to the existing law. But they got everybody stupid enough to believe that emergency powers apply to anything and everything necessary for the governor to do. And actually, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, it's very clear that the state cannot exercise powers not delegated, or they cannot pass laws or enforce laws that violate the privileges and immunities of U.S. citizens. There's no emergency clause in the U.S. Constitution. Because a lot of people are sick and got runny noses, now the governor can then step in. No. There's no exceptions in the 14th Amendment. There is no exceptions in the Constitution because the states have a little bit of a flu going on. The bottom line is the only way those laws could change is by the state legislatures prescribed by the Constitution. Therefore, all those 40-some states that changed the electoral process for the 2020 election, those were illegitimate, and the electors that were chosen were illegitimately chosen. Therefore, there was no legitimate electoral college. Therefore, the vote should have gone straight to the House of Representatives, and based on the representation, not the quantity of representation, but the representation of states red and blue, there were 30 red states and 20 blue states. So guess who would have won the election in 2020?
Yes, sir. And Mr. Trump.
And who was the president pro temp at the time?
Was it Kamala?
No, she not in 2020.
Yeah, she's the Senate. Oh, no, it was Pence.
There you go. Thank you so much. So, folks, as we're going into break, Sean basically laid out that Pence was the guy that undermined the election of 2020. It was his responsibility. So I'm going to bring this back up to bring him in on this. So there's no point in keeping to pipe in on this. So at this point, I will stop myself here, and we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me bring Sean back in, because you were right. It was Pence. And Pence didn't even challenge, and as a matter of fact, so what you don't know is that Bob Schultz, myself, and even legislatures from Montana and other states, as well as citizens from other states, combined, there was Bob Schultz basically created this wave of First Amendment petitions to every member of Congress. Did you ever hear this?
I have not heard of that.
Okay, so prior to the seating and the oath of, you know, getting everybody sworn into Congress, prior to that, Bob Schultz showed up in D.C. It was like the 2nd of January. And he, because at this point in time, D.C. was locked down unconstitutionally. We had First Amendment petitions to petition Congress for the redress of grievances. And, oh, by the way, what's the First Amendment say?
Congress shall make no law.
Congress shall make no law. That is absolutely right. Respecting the establishment of religion, or shall make no law, respecting the people to peaceably assemble and petition government for the redress of grievances. Or actually, they can't make a law that abridges the right for the people to peaceably assemble. So, to be clear, Congress actually made it impossible for the people to petition government. We're shut down. We don't care what you say. Because we had a petition coming, and they had thousands of signatures. And Bob Schultz accounted for all of that. And when he finally got in there, it took him 2 days. But by the third day, end of the third, by the second day, the end of the 3rd of January, he received a confirmation from the security, the House, or the Capitol security team, that every member of Congress, even the president pro tem, received a copy of the petition notifying them of the unconstitutional forming of the electors, that the electors must be rejected because there is an insufficient number, legitimate number, to be able to choose the president. Because technically, if you look at what that number is today, it's 270. They only had 139. So they couldn't choose. Therefore, we basically told them that they needed to invoke the 12th Amendment, and that it would go down the path of the House of Representatives choosing. Everybody knew what was going to happen. And actually, this would have outed Liz Cheney, because she was going to vote against President Trump. And she would have lost that seat in the next coming election. And it took, I think, two elections for her to finally lose her seat. Now, maybe I think it was that. I think what her actions in January 6th really, you know, kind of killed her in 2022. So I think that's when she lost her seat anyway. But nevertheless, she would have voted, you know, for Biden. But I think all of the rest of the Republicans, they would have voted for Trump, which means that Trump would have, or I should say the Republican-dominated states, they would have actually pursued and won. So why is it that Pence did what he did? He wanted to make sure Trump wasn't the president again. And this guy, Pence has this knack for being able to speak out of, I think he's probably one, a professional ventriloquist, as well as, you know, a professional soothsayer, to actually be able to say things that are in direct contradictions and make it seem like it's all makes sense and it's all jives. And so anyway, I digress. So now what we are looking at is, where were we? What did we leave off with? I think that kind of wrapped that up, didn't it?
Article 2, yes.
Yes, Article 2, and that would be Section 2, right? No. Actually, there's still some parts to Article 1. Or is this? Yeah, this is Article 1 still. So we finished the 12th Amendment part. So now we go back to the next part underneath the 12th Amendment, what you just read. And that's where the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. That's one thing that Congress will choose, determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes. So in other words, they basically, Congress has the control over federal elections for the choosing of electors. That happens once every 4 years. In other words, the presidential election. The regular elections for federal elections, the states dictate that. Now, the next caveat is a standard, right? Now, in this particular case, it's being violated. It has been violated, but are you with me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's go ahead and dive into this and go ahead and read the full paragraph.
No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained to the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States.
Now, why is that a resident and talking about a natural-born citizen?
Because at the time, there were people who they had to have somebody to be president, and they were setting it up for after that time had passed. At the time, they might have had people who weren't 35 years old that didn't meet the eligibility.
Okay, so there were two different acts, and in March 26, 1790, Congress passed an act that basically talked about the natural born citizen, and they said, be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America, Congress assembled, that any alien, being a free white person, who shall have resided within the limits and under the jurisdiction of the United States for the term of 2 years, may be admitted to become a citizen thereof on application to any common law court. Now, where are the common law courts? Because it's not a federal court. State, right? Okay, so they have to go to the state of record in any one of the states wherein they shall or he shall have resided for the term of 1 year, at least, in making proof and satisfaction of such court that he is a person in good character, and taking the oath or affirmation prescribed by law to support the Constitution. This is, they have to do this, which oath and affirmation such court shall administer the clerk and shall be considered as a citizen of the United States, and the children of such person so naturalized dwelling with naturalized, not naturally born, but naturalized, within the United States, being under the age of 21 years of age at the time of such naturalization. So in other words, a person under the age of 21 cannot pursue citizenship. If you're a foreigner, you have to wait until 21 and then be naturalized. If you're a child or born here under a citizen who has no jurisdiction, you obtain the jurisdiction of your parents, which means you're not a citizen, which means you have to go through the naturalization. And when your parents naturalize, then you are naturalized with them if you're 21 years or less. And then it goes on and says, and the children of citizens of the United States that may be born beyond the sea or out in the limits of the United States shall be considered as natural born citizens, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to persons whose fathers have never been resident of the United States. So in other words, if your father was at this point in time a member of the United States, he was a citizen of the United States, but he never resided, and he had, you know, a family, their children would not be, if he never resided in the United States, would never be considered natural born, even though he is a legitimate citizen. So they actually created this little caveat that the father would have to be a citizen of the United States and reside within it, and they actually put the limit on there of how many years he would have to reside. Being, let me see here, have never resided, citizen before. What is the limit on that? Provided also. There's got to be a limitation on the time of what they, I think it may be in the next act, to where they identify that he has to have had residency for a year or two or something like that. Because I think, for the applied citizenship, heredity of nobility, kingdom of states, addition. So in the 1975 Act, or 1795 Act, they kind of went down this path of kind of clarifying a lot of this stuff. They also talk about the, you know, abjuring any allegiance to any other state. And I think they talk about, is it 3 years before they're, so they have to be then a resident for 3 years of a state. And the interesting thing is that if a state chooses not to admit a citizen, then the state of where they chose, okay, whose father never been a resident, I think that they just have, he has to be a resident for just any short period of time. It's if he's never been a resident, then you can, that his children can't be citizens, natural born citizens, not natural born. They have to naturalize. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It's also in here where they talk about the legislature has to actually give authority to citizenship. I'm only, this is a rat hole, but Okay. So it goes right here. This is the only place where it says legislature. And it says right here, Section 3. And it further be enacted that the children of persons duly naturalized dwelling within the United States and being under the age of 21 at the time of such naturalization, and the children of citizens of the United States born outside the limits and the jurisdiction of the United States shall be considered citizens of the United States, provided that the citizenship shall not descend on a person whose father has never been a resident again, provided also that no person heretofore prescribed by any state who has been legally convicted of having joined the Army of Great Britain during the late war shall be admitted as a citizen as aforesaid without the consent of the legislature of the state thereof. And so that kind of helps point out that, one, if you were in the British Army in any way, then you couldn't become a citizen without the state legislature approving that. In addition, there's this other clause here. And the children of citizens of the United States that may be born beyond the sea and limits of the United States shall be considered as a natural born citizen, provided that the right of citizenship shall not descend to persons whose fathers shall not reside, been resident of the United States, provided also that no person heretofore prescribed by any states shall be admitted a citizen as aforesaid, except by an act of the legislature of the state which such person was so prescribed. In other words, the state legislature has the authority to deny a person citizenship to the United States. And the only way that person can then become a citizen if they move to another state and that state says, yeah, we'll let you become a citizen, they actually have to go to the original state legislature that said, hey, this person can't become a citizen. Why? because when you become a citizen, the rights of the citizen extend to all states. In other words, this reciprocity. So that person that they didn't want as a citizen can now come into their state. And so that's why the original authority goes back to the first state that denied them, or all states that denied them. And then they go, okay, yeah, we'll allow. And then finally that person can become citizen. In other words, the states actually have this control over whether a person can actually apply to become citizen or not. Most people don't know that either. Anyway, I digress. So we're back into Article 1, Section 2, Article 2, I mean, Section 1 still, and covered the natural-born citizen in that paragraph. And in this particular case, this was changed by the 25th Amendment. So we could read this. And we probably should read both together like we did with the 12th Amendment. But this is really something that goes into the removal or resignation of that type of stuff. So we'll just read this and then keep in mind with the 25th Amendment. There is a process of disqualifying or potentially removing a president because of his abilities or inabilities or resigning and so forth. So let's go ahead and get this one in.
Get back to my place. In case of the removal from president, from office, or his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president. And the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and vice president, declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act accordingly until the disability be removed or a president shall be elected. And as you said, modified by...
Yes, by the 25th Amendment, yes. Okay, and when we dive into that, all of that is all changed. So that was the old school process of disabling and removing and so forth. But the next one here is pointing out as being violated. Let's go ahead and read this one. And then let's think about how this is being violated. Go ahead.
The president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected. And he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them.
Okay, so... What's an emolument? Do you know what the synonym or what the word emolument means? You know, what's the synonym? It's a payment. Any other payment, remuneration, reward, fee, compensation. If you look up the word emolument, what does that word mean? Because it says he shall not receive within that period any other emolument.
Would benefit...
Right, a benefit like healthcare benefits.
Security benefits.
Security benefits. That's right.
And don't they get...
Yes.
I could be wrong. Don't they get a salary for life?
Well,
or
so...
once they're out of office.
But they're only compensated for their time that cannot be increased or diminished while they're in service, and once they're out of service, they don't get compensation. This is correct. Right here, it caps what the president can get, and that's it. The fact that he gets all sorts of other emoluments in itself is a violation of the Constitution. The fact that when he leaves as former president, he is able to maintain a security detail, payment, access to, you know, to resources and so forth, being able to have, you know, receive briefings and those types of things, and being able to tap people in the office as the former president. That becomes a title of nobility. The former president has become a title of nobility, which the United States cannot establish a title of nobility. Does he understand that?
Okay. Yes, sir.
All right, now his oath of office.
Like a plane or something like that?
Yeah, well, there's that. But, I mean, the title of nobility means that he's like a king. He's the former president, but he's still like a king, and he can travel around the world as former president and speak to world dignitaries and leaders. And it's clear, we can get into the Logan Act. You may want to look that up, the Logan Act. It is clear that the active administration is the only administration that has access and controls access to the heads of states of the rest of the world. They bar Congress or any other person, any other citizen of the United States, like a former president, from being able to walk in and have meetings, or a person like Bill Gates to walk in and have meetings with heads of states. If you look up the Logan Act, that's a huge violation. And technically, it's one thing to just have the meeting, but when you understand the context of the meeting that Bill Gates is having, those meetings are treasonous. He's literally calling for and working with undermining our own government. Anyway, okay, so now let's get into the oath.
Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. Quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Okay, so that actually has, you know, not just support. It actually doesn't say support. It says preserve, protect, and defend. Right? It's a little different. The state of Wyoming has support, defend, and obey in their oath. The minimum requirement for everybody else is that they must support. Some states actually, like I said, Wyoming has raised the bar and said, you not only will support, but you must support, defend, and obey the Constitution of the United States and the state of Wyoming. Okay, so that is their oath. I guess if you look, because you asked this question, is there something unique about this ability to preserve, protect, and defend? I guess it would create a door or a portal in a impeachment process of discerning whether he failed to preserve. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so I could see how that might become a contention that could be used as a impeachment thing. But anyway, let's move into section two now. So there's some pretty interesting things here that some people don't know. And what's going to end up happening in the next year is going to be the State of the Union. And this happened 4 years ago, or actually no, it was 8 years ago when Trump did his first State of the Union and Pelosi wanted to play these games. So we can talk about that, but it's going to actually talk about who actually has the control over the State of the Union. Let's go ahead. Section 2.
Section 2. The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
Okay. Pretty clear. Any questions on that?
No, sir.
Okay. So let's go into the next one.
He shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate and by with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law, but the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments.
Okay. All right. And that last line to that. Go ahead.
The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session.
Okay, so in other words, those are temporary fills until the Senate comes back, and he can then formally go through the advice and consent process of filling the positions. That's all. And so Obama violated the Constitution by just making him permanent, and so the Supreme Court slapped him on that. That would have been an offense, technically, because he violated the Constitution. That would have been an offense of impeachment. Congress should have impeached him because he violated separation of powers. But anyway, so the next one is where I believe he really gets more focused into the ambassadors and that type of thing. Let me see here. Does he talk about ambassadors? Shall receive ambassadors, ministers, and shall take care of faithful the law. Okay, yeah. Because up above is where he has the appointment of administering and shall appoint ministers, judges, and all these other things in working with. Okay? So let's go ahead into three.
He shall, from time to time, give to Congress, information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper.
Okay, let's stop right there. Because that's the one thing I was talking about. He shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their considerations such as measures he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may on extraordinary occasions convene both houses, convene them, or either of them, and in some cases of disagreement between them with respect to times of adjournments. So he can call them forth and he can adjourn them, but what's important is up above, the information for the State of the Union. He shall from time to time give that information. Did you see anywhere in Article 1 where the Speaker of the House would have the responsibility of calling forth the President to give him a State of the Union? See, it is the President's responsibility, not Nancy Pelosi. There you go. So we're actually out of time. It's almost perfect that we ended right here. Let's think about that, because let's look at what Nancy Pelosi did to him 8 years ago in trying to say, well, we're going to put this off. We're not going to make a big deal out of bringing you in anytime faster than we think expedient. And they started playing those types of games amongst each other when technically it was the president's duty and responsibility to call the time to do it. And so I don't see anywhere in the Constitution where Nancy Pelosi had the authority to do what she did. Anyway, with that, we've wrapped up Article 2, Section 3, or almost Section 3. We'll cover the rest of it. I'm Jerome Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.